Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars, creators, and industry leaders bringing Broadway and the theater industry back to life. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, we're looking to the future and finding out what theater and live performance need to move forward, and hearing it from the artists, leaders, donors, and administrators who are on the ground and doing the work. Earlier this year, the Sundance Institute commissioned the artist, producer, and longtime dramaturg Jesse Cameron Alec to conduct an in-depth study to discover what the Institute, and by extension, the entire theater field, can learn from the events of 2020. Alec is the former company dramaturg at the Public Theater and has just recently been appointed the Associate Artistic Director at the Vineyard Theater. And for the study, he spoke to more than 70 theater people, many of whom have appeared on this very podcast, including Lynn Nottage, Michael R. Jackson, Whitney White, Maria Goyanis, Shayna Taub, Nataki Garrett, and many more. Alec is in the virtual studio with me to tell us what theater makers have learned, what they lost, and what they urgently need to carry them into the future. Hey, Jesse, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I wonder if we could start off with just having you tell us a little bit about the impetus behind the study and how you got involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's see, everything starts with the Sundance Theater Program, which, as I'm sure you know, occupied such an important place in the theater community for over 40 years, I believe. So the artistic director there, Philip Hinberg, left, and Carrie Putnam, who is the brilliant executive director over at Sundance, oversees everything that Sundance does, really wanted to figure out a way that the program could reinvent itself. And she started sort of chatting with people, you know, about like what the future of the field was and what the future of theater was. And she had great gut instincts.
Actually, before we go too far down that, we should maybe back up just a little bit to talk about, for people who are maybe not familiar with what the Sundance Theater Institute does, if they're more familiar with the film festival or something. I mean, chances are the Sundance Theater Institute was involved in multiple shows you have seen on Broadway or at your local playhouse or things like that. They are a big developmental sort of powerhouse in terms of the talent they get and the projects that end up sort of moving on from there, right?
I couldn't agree more with you. Sundance, the theater program at Sundance has touched so many different projects that I love and are close to my heart. A Passing Strange, which was one of the first musicals, you know, that I really worked on at the Public Theater. And it just like, you know, it felt like Stu reached into my life and read my diary out loud with that one. And that started at Sundance, as well as Fun Home, as well as a number of big sort of projects. And the way that the Sundance program works is that they take artists and they take them to their place in Utah, their retreat center in Utah, which is completely gorgeous, up in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of nowhere. And they just give them all the resources that they possibly can give artists. And there's no producers come there. And the artists are just allowed to work for 3 weeks on whatever they want to work on. And it's been a really successful model for producing good work.
Yeah. But so now it sounds like they're thinking about making some changes. Tell us more about sort of that and the survey, how the survey is involved.
Sure. After Philip left, Carrie had the sort of gut instinct that theater program needed to change. And I think that she had a gut instinct that a lot of people in the field had, that like things needed to change. And boy, was she right. You know, and I think the pandemic hit and we realized everything really needed to change. I've been a dramaturg with Sundance over the last like 3 or 4 years. They bring me up to their retreats and I was lucky enough to sit, you know, and talk with amazing artists. And so Carrie and I have known each other for quite a while. And when the pandemic hit, she and I started to get into conversations. And over the course of 6 months, we just talked about what the field, what was happening in the field, and what we wanted to have happen. And eventually I asked Carrie if I could take the baton from her on this sort of, on the conversations that she had already started with a number of people in the field. And then I took the baton and I kind of ran with it. The original idea for this study was to be an internal document for Sundance. And I was instructed to talk to people about the field and talk to them about Sundance and how the Sundance, the impact of the Sundance Theater Program and where it could go and how it could expand. And I definitely got into those conversations. But as I talked with people, it was kind of amazing. We just started to talk about everything. We started talking about, you know, the Black Lives Matter resurgence, you know, the theater field in general, how we paid our artists, who should be leading us, who is in the conversations. And as I spoke with them, the interviews just became bigger and the project became bigger than it originally was. And like the good producer and dramaturg I am, I decided to create a new form to fit the bigness of the sort of vision of it. And that's how we have the study right now.
Right. Yeah. And so what, from your impression, what did you feel like, you sort of touched on this a little bit, what did you feel like Sundance in particular wanted to get out of this study? And then what did you personally want to get out of, or, you know, creatively, professionally want to get out of this study as you started doing it?
And those things overlap. If there's a Venn diagram of what Sundance wanted and what I wanted, there'd be some overlap, but there'd be some differences too. Because I will say that Sundance wanted to know what the future of live performance was going to be like, theater and live performance. And they wanted to have real findings from people who had gone to Sundance and people who had not gone to Sundance about what the field's impression of Sundance was, where the place that it held in the field, the position that it held, and the place that it could hold. Sundance has always had a sort of separation of church and state policy with the field. They don't let producers go to their retreats. They try and keep the art separated from the sort of business of it all. And they were wondering if that was the right way to move forward. So I definitely had a lot of conversations with people about that, you know, and I think that goal was met. And I will say that, like, in terms of what I wanted from this sort of project was, one, I definitely wanted to help Sundance. I have a vested interest in the theater program coming back. I think it was vital to what the field is, and I think it was vital to the work that they do at Sundance, and so I really wanted to be involved in that. But I will also say that an impulse that was like that attracted me to this project and really overcame me was the opportunity to gossip with people. You know, this is what we do so much in the theater, is we talk, you know, and if I have one talent as a dramaturg, it's my talent to sit with people and have a conversation and let the truth rise to the surface. And so the opportunity to go and talk with people for just an hour, all these interviews were less than an hour for the most part, and just talk to them about how they were doing and what was going on, what their ideas were, was incredibly attractive, and it did not disappoint. I will say that the pandemic was hard, you know, for all of us. It was hard for me, especially, and just getting the opportunity to talk with people, it saved me.
And before we get into the sort of specifics of what you found in this survey, what broadly did you find you got from this study that you maybe didn't expect, you personally?
That is a very good question. I think there was like a lot of sort of surprising things. I'd say the first most surprising thing is that I spoke with a lot of different artists and different arts workers from all across the United States, from a number of different countries. And the exact same things came up in the conversation. And seeing the sort of collective consciousness at work was delightful. And seeing literally dozens of people talking to me about the same problem and offering up similar solutions to that problem was a beautiful thing. It really made me think, despite being separate, we in sort of theater and live performance, we're on the same page. We all understand what the problems are. We might argue about the solutions, but we know what's wrong in the sort of like field. And then one of the biggest, you know, and I'm sure we'll come to this later on, but one of the biggest findings that I found surprising and beautiful was the idea of field ideation. That the idea that theater and live performance need a home for thought and conversation. And that right now, we do not have an ability to have a healthy conversation.
Right.
I think our conversations get very tense. I think that oftentimes leadership and people at institutions clam up and hold things tight, and they're very, very worried. There's quite a lot of fear and apprehension in the field. And we have to, like any family, we have to figure out how to talk to each other and work things out. And so many people said the exact same thing.
Yeah. Before we go more into that, let's talk a little bit more about the pool of people you talk to, sort of how many people you talk to and what your goals were in terms of the makeup of who they are and what their, how they identified on whatever level and what their various roles were in the industry. How did you sort of think about putting that group together?
Absolutely. So I started with the sort of goals with Sundance. With Michelle Satter and Carrie Putnam at Sundance, we talked about the goals quite a lot. And we set the sort of like modest goals of me talking to 40 different individuals and then writing a 10-page report, which makes me smile because like that didn't happen, because as I started to talk to people, people would say to me, are you talking to so-and-so? And then I talked to that person. They were like, have you talked to so-and-so? And so it led me on a kind of journey where eventually I ended up interviewing 76 people. And I believe that the report, including all the profiles, is about 150 pages now, which is completely delightful. So the goal was to, you know, have a breadth of people, you know, to have represented, you know, artists and arts workers, to have different disciplines represented, to have, you know, not only theater, but actually theater and live performance, which is an important distinction, because we were even in the sort of impulse in the study, we were questioning what theater is. You know, and that theater belongs to a bigger family, which is theater and live performance. And I think the pandemic was really, right from the very beginning, it started to blur the lines between what is theater and what is live performance. So we wanted a lot of representation, you know, in all of that. And of course, you know, because of who I am and how I walk through the world, it was really important for me to have a lot of sort of different racial representations as well. The methodology, I will say, that I used was not, you know, I don't think that like you could put my methodology in a book, because essentially, I said, who do I want to talk to? You know, who do I miss? You know, who's smart? Who would I go to for advice? And I just started hitting up the sort of like, you know, artists that I know personally, or artists that I know their work. And I know that they have said smart things. And I just sort of started to collect people. The interdisciplinary staff at the Sundance Institute also contributed a number of names of people that I didn't know, especially people working at interdisciplinary new media sort of people. And that was fantastic as well. But I did definitely, my methodology was to reach my hands into the pool that exists and see what came back.
Primarily artists or entirely artists, or there were some who are not. Tell us more about sort of who, in addition to kind of playwrights and other creators, like who else did, what other kinds of roles in the industry did you talk to?
I mean, primarily artists. This question demands the follow-up question, what is an artist? You know, which I'll set aside for later on. It was definitely like sort of playwrights and directors, you know, traditional playwrights, directors, lyricists, composers, you know, it was choreographers as well. It was a lot of interdisciplinary artists and by that I mean people who are working with new media and often live on stage, but working with, you know, sort of technology in an interesting way. For example, Valencia James is an artist who uses sort of motion capture on her body and then dances in digital environments live in front of a digital audience. Before the pandemic, she danced in front of an actual in-person audience, and now she dances in digital environments for a digital sort of audience. So those sort of artists as well, as well as people who work at institutions, a number of artistic directors, a number of dramaturgs, those sorts of folks, and then a number of donors as well. I think I spoke with three or four donors, people who sit on boards of directors of various sort of institutions. And then lastly, I would say thought leaders, you know, people who are smart and interesting and who we should listen to, you know. And there was definitely a lot of overlap in all these sort of categories. The thought leaders are some of the most interesting kinds of people. They do a lot of different things in the theater and live performance fields. But the definition of who they are is sort of tricky.
And so there's no sort of commercial element in terms of what you were looking for in terms of talking to a commercial producer, for instance, or something like that. Was that something you thought about?
Thank you for pointing that out, Gordon. I did speak to a couple of commercial theater producers as well. You know, Mara Isaacs runs Octopus Theatricals, and she was one of the commercial theater producers that I spoke with. It's interesting, you know, because she, and even in
she herself, has an institutional background, right?
Exactly. She exists in a liminal space, you know. So even thinking about Mara as a commercial theater producer is a little tricky in my head, even though I know, of course, she does do that.
Yeah, right. And so these were virtually conducted, I'm guessing, the interviews?
Every single one of these interviews was conducted right here, where we are right now. And it was all recorded. It was all recorded on Zoom, and then I did the transcripts afterwards. There was lots of questions that were asked. I mean, we had some form questions that Sundance helped me come up with. But it's worth saying that the conversations took a life of their own.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is there, I imagine people had a lot to say, it sounds like.
Oh, they had a lot to say. They were spilling all the tea, all the gossip. And it was totally delightful to talk with them, you know, about what was going on and what their experience was, you know, because like we were all locked apart from each other. And in many ways, we still are locked apart from each other. And people really had like interesting things to say and interesting reflections. I think the pandemic also, it's worth saying, has changed us. it's changed us all individually, you know, being scared in our homes and really thinking about like what we're doing as artists, as people who work in theater, you know, what we can contribute. And it's made people more honest. And more, you know, forthright and really demanding things, you know, demanding the truth. So it's worth saying that the conversations were very honest. People told me the absolute truth. I also said to every single person that, you know, if you say anything you don't want it in the report, I will not put it in the report. You know, there are no gotcha moments, you know, there is no scandal. I'm not trying to out anyone. And that actually freed people up to just talk to me about whatever they want.
I'll have more with Jesse right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And now, here's more with Jesse Cameron Alec.
And so what did they talk to you about? Talk us through sort of broadly what you found and what you ended up discussing, sort of distilling down the kind of all the many voices into kind of broader themes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say this, you know, as I talked with people, I interviewed people, I asked them what they did and who they are. I asked them about what the pandemic had taken from them and what the pandemic had given to them. I asked them about their experience in the Black Lives Matter resurgence, you know, what they thought about the field, how the field was handling white supremacy and anti-Blackness more specifically. I talked to them about what they thought the future was going to be. I talked to them about what they thought the future was going to be and what they wanted the future to be, you know? We talked about a lot of different things in these sort of things. And it's worth saying that when I started this study, I didn't know the form the study was going to take. And then as I spoke with people started repeating the same things, you know, like all the conversations, probably about halfway through my interviews, I started to see the themes. They were rising towards the top and people very largely agreed upon the most important things for the theater and live performance fields to concentrate in the future on.
Right. So tell us about those. Talk us through those.
Okay, great. I'll just go in order because that's the way I think of, about them. Even as I talk, I've lived with this report for such a long time, you know, and it just like really, you know, it exists in my head.
Wait, you started in January, is that right?
January is when I started main theaters, yeah. Which is interesting because like I will say that like I think that time moves so quickly now. And so these interviews were captured between January and I would say end of April of this year. But even in the last 2 months, things have started to evolve. But what I will say is I'm very pleased to watch as things start to change. They're matching my themes. I'm glad that reality actually agrees with the sort of conclusions that I came up with. So the first theme was shared leadership. And this was the idea of really discussing the way in which the way that we have leaders structured in the American theater and sort of the international theater is a system that isn't working. And that a lot of people know that it's not working. And it hasn't been working for a while. And breaking open the idea that this is the only way that we can have, that we can run institutions or run theaters, and that there are different ways.
Yeah. You're talking specifically about the sort of hierarchical artistic director, for instance, one, you know, kind of tentpole position that
I absolutely has I absolutely am. Whether you call that person an artistic director or, you know, artistic producer or head, you know, curator, they're sort of called different things depending on the institution. But like, yes, we're talking about the person in charge and that person making all the decisions about what is good and what is substandard and how to lead the institution. And like the really sort of big takeaway that I got from my interviews and the conclusion that I set forth in the study is that the solution to this system of cisgendered white male supremacy in sort of like, you know, these institutions is not to get rid of all the white guys leading the institutions and replace them with black guys leading the institutions. That's actually not the solution. And people knew that. It's the solution rather was to reshape the idea of leadership itself, you know, and bring and start experimenting with other ideas of shared or circular leadership, where that has, maybe you have four artistic directors, like the Wilma Theater has, where each season a different artistic director is curating it. But all throughout, all the artistic directors are there helping out with the sort of process. So four different artistic directors, or you have one artistic director that doesn't make any of the decisions without a council of sort of people, or you have two artistic directors. They're always in conversation with each other. The idea that institutions can be led by one person is kind of, I think it's an antique sort of idea. And I think it's also connected to the capitalist way in which we think of things, of one person being great. And the idea that a lot of people have brought forth was everyone can be great, you know, and that if we have shared leadership, it will actually bring in different points of view into the conversation. It will put leadership into conflict with itself, you know, where we actually have to have conversations about things that we disagree upon. And that will actually lead to more exciting things, experimentation, riskier art.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's one.
That's and, one of them. Yeah. There's four, you know, so
yeah. We'll
get to it. The next one was holistic artist support.
Right.
You know, it's worth saying, like, Gordon, a lot of these sort of themes, like when you talk about them sort of casually, they have a kind of, yeah, totally, you know, they have a feeling to them of, I kind of knew that, like, you right. know, like for example, with holistic artist support, you know, I a number of people talk to me about how artists are not doing well. And they haven't been doing well in the sort of theater live performance field for a really long time. I will say that institutionally, before the pandemic, I think things were going great for institutions. I think money was being made. I think there was, like, you know, a sort of a lot of institutions had deals with commercial theater producers and Broadway, and there was, like, you know, real revenue streams that were being built. But the money wasn't getting to the artists. The sort of industry remained a place that if you want to be a theater and live performance artist, you have to have another job or you have to be supported, you know, by something else, you know, like family inheritance or something like that. And then the pandemic hit. And then I think that everything was laid bare, you know, in terms of like pretty much every single one of my friends was on unemployment.
Right. And so holistic artistic support would be things like childcare, or are you thinking sort of broadly for their just, you know, basic human well-being? Is that the kind of like things that people were talking about?
Childcare is something that was brought up in the study, absolutely. And the idea of thinking about people's lives in a holistic sort of, 365 degree sort of way. But what I'm talking about is paying artists. Talking about paying artists more, you know, I'm talking about cash in people's
just
hands.
Straight up, yeah.
And not only paying artists more, because I think like if we take actors, paying actors more, you know, is one sort of step, but a bigger step is actually hiring artists, institutions actually hiring artists. It's, you know, it's easy to make, you know, a living in the theater if you're a marketing manager. Right. Or if you're a development officer, if you're like a company dramaturg, you know, although sometimes easy. But like, it's hard to make a living in the theater if you're a playwright. And now this is like an inverted pyramid, right? You know, where like, you know, we make all of our money off of a small number of artists and we make a lot of money, enough to support, you know, thousands of arts workers, and yet not enough money to support the artists themselves. The solution is just to hire artists, institutions to just hire artists, give them a salary, give them health insurance, give them all the benefits, and let them write, you know, let them be directors, let them be designers, let them create work. And it's not just a nice thing to do, you know, I think that we should do it just because it's a nice thing to do, but it's actually the way to create great art also.
Yeah. Huh. And And then there's one of the themes involves digital theater as well. Is that right?
It does. Digital theater and hybrid futures.
Yeah.
That theme specifically talked about theater's relationship with technology.
Yeah.
You know, and I often say as a joke to people that if we had our way, theater people would still be lighting the stage with candles. But the amazing thing about this pandemic is it dragged us kicking and screaming, you know, 5-10 years into the future. And suddenly overnight, you know, we had to reckon with things. We had to reckon with Zoom. And listen, a lot of my friends would tell me that, you know, Zoom is a horrible thing. And, you know, the art on Zoom is really quite questionable. But I would say that's an interesting thing to say, I think, because if you look at the art on Zoom, sometimes it can be questionable if it wasn't created for Zoom. But if, as we know, as artists, you create the art for the medium. And if you look at the work that was actually created for the medium of Zoom, it's amazing, you know? And of course, there are so many different platforms outside of Zoom. And artists have been working on Twitch, on, you know, all sorts of different sorts of things, you know, and creating kind of amazing art over the last year.
And what was did you find the consensus was in terms of what makes something theatrical when it exists in another medium? And how do you find people are imagining the way hybrid theater will, I think anyway, continue to exist even after we can all, you know, fully, safely be in a room together and breathe the same air.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I will say, you know, at the top of this, that I don't think that theater is going away, traditional theater. I don't think that, you know, plays and musicals and experimental theater pieces are going away and we're all going to, like, just do this digitally. I think people are starving to be in rooms with each other. And I don't think there's any replacing that sort of experience. But the question was raised, like, a number of times. So what is live? What are we doing? You know, this, you know, conversation that we're having right now, Gordon, this is live, you know, we're both human beings in spaces, even though we're not in the same space with each other. And there's a quality to the conversation that's a live conversation. And I think that the same thing was discovered with a lot of the sort of digital work that was created over the last year. I know a lot of theater artists that have projects in the works where it is a live sort of performance with people in a space with each other, but there are elements of the performance that are happening digitally at the same time and being beamed in some sort of way into people's sort of world.
Yeah, and there are so many reasons to incorporate that aren't just creative, but also in terms of expanding accessibility and things like that, right? Like, there are so many reasons to sort of keep a lot of what we have learned from.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a knife that cuts both ways, because in terms of accessibility, and I go into this in my study in some ways, you know, this year, like, I think really opened up accessibility for a lot of artists with disabilities. They were able to create art and witness art much more, you know, than they were in the olden times. And then at the same time, a lot of artists that I spoke with, you know, in the United States and in other countries talked about the barriers that technology, you know, puts up as in terms of access. So, like, doing just digital theater would be a mistake, you know, because it would have just as many barriers. But the future is going to be about doing both and finding the pathway to them. I might just add also that an interesting sort of conclusion that I found in the report was that the artists who were already interdisciplinary artists, that were already hyphenate artists, did better during the pandemic. They were able to pivot. They were able to put their resources somewhere else, their creative resources into something else, and they were able to continue to create, which is a reason why we should actually be investing in our artists and teaching them the sort of material skills that comes along with technology.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, field ideation is a biggie of one of the big things you came out of this study with, or talking about, thinking about. What's that mean? And what does it look like? Do people think it might look like in the future?
Field ideation is a very fancy way of saying talking about ideas. And I think that, like, over the last year, it has been really interesting to witness the field have conversations, because we've been having a lot of conversations, you know, and they have been deep and interesting, and there have been a lot of emotions involved in them, and people have enthusiastically joined the conversations, and people have enthusiastically backed out of the conversations as well. And I will say that, like, the sort of a diagnosis, if I was a doctor talking to the American theater, I'd say, you don't know how to talk. You know, you are a family that does not know how to get into a healthy conversations with each other. It's hard to hear the truth, and it's hard to actually respond to the truth and come up with like ideas and solutions. So it's interesting. Field ideation is my last theme that I talk about in my study, but I actually think it's the first one to start with. You know, that if the field was going to take on something first, it would be field ideation. It'd be creating these sort of centers where we can get into conversations about what's going on. What are the problems? You know, what have we suffered with over the last year? What have we suffered with in the years before that? You know, and really dig into what the solutions are. Because I will also say that like this report filled me with a lot of hope. There are smart minds out there in our field, and they have ideas, and a lot of the ideas are good ones. And we need to talk about those ideas and figure them out.
And what does the forum look like? Did anyone sort of imagine what a possible forum for this kind of conversation about ideas might be, or how, one might convince a family to talk, to engage in more healthy conversation with its members?
I'll say this, in terms of as with, you know, theater and live performance in general is about the place. It's about the location that it happens in. And so a lot of people talked about that. Where do we have these conversations? We are in a time right now where artists and a lot of arts workers too have a deep mistrust of institutions. So what is the right institution to have this conversation? What is the sort of, you know, where do we locate this conversation? A lot of people like sort of talk about parameters about that. You know, what is an ethical institution that can hold these conversations? But no one came to a conclusion about that. And also no one came to a conclusion about the form that these conversations should take necessarily. My study in general gives a lot of sort of ideas, and it doesn't give a lot of conclusions. It doesn't give a lot of solutions to what our problems are necessarily. But I think the first step is like realizing that you have a problem, you know, and then actually being willing to step into the conversation about, let's talk about that sort of problem and figure that out. I know with this study, the Sundance Institute, as soon as we talked, I presented the internal study to them. They're immediately like, let's rewrite this thing for the field. And then like right after that, Carrie, you know, ambitious, you know, person that she is, was like, hey, let's figure out a way to have this conversation in a bigger way, you know? So like, that's what this entire effort is, you know, we've made, you know, a presentation. We also made a film version of this presentation directed by filmmaker Zach Murphy so that people can witness it in different sort of ways, depending on how people take in information.
And where is that? Is that available? You've made the study available at a website called emergingfromthecave.com. Is that where that film lives as well?
So everything is going to be is going to live on emergingfromthecave.com. So if you go to that website, you'll be able to, one, see the presentation, which is totally beautiful and designed very well, and then you'll also be able to see the film, which is beautiful. If you can stand my voice for that long, you know. And then also we have a feedback portal also where we're hoping that people like go to this website, they witness the presentation, or they see the film, or they do both, and then they give us feedback about things that we missed. I'm only one person, and I did this in 6 months, and there are tons of things that I missed and tons of ideas that I did not capture in this. And the hopes is that we can start gathering these sort of other ideas and figure out the sort of next step. And Carrie is very excited about the idea of also doing a live convening of this sort of, you know, to discuss this document, discuss the ideas in it, you know, sort of wisdom held, and also talk about all the things that this document missed and continue the conversation.
Yeah. We spoke a little bit about this before we turned the microphones on, but you are in a process of transition yourself. You are just starting a new gig at a new theater for you. How do all the things that you have learned from this study, how do you anticipate all the things you have learned from this study influencing the way you do your job going forward?
Yeah. And as I said, when we were talking, Gordon, you've caught me at such an interesting day. It's my last day at the Public Theater after 15 years, which is an institution that I literally grew up in. You know, I became a man at the Public Theater. And then also I've started at the Vineyard Theater as the Associate Artistic Director. I feel like the universe always rhymes. You know, things happen at the same time to influence, you know, things. And I don't think that like this moment could have been better shaped. Doing this report taught me a lot. It shaped me. It made me think about what artists need and what my priorities should be, and what really the priorities that everyone should have at institutions. But I'll speak for myself that, like, doing this report and, you know, spending so much time with it really taught me how I should be working as someone who is a supporter of artists. So I anticipate carrying a lot, you know, into my sort of new roles at the Vineyard.
Can you give us some specifics by any chance in terms of insights that you gained that you maybe hadn't thought as much as you feel like you should have previous to this?
I'll say this, you know, a big sort of insight that I had doing this report is that racism and anti-blackness in the theater is real. It's really real. And of course, I'm a black man. I'm working in the American theater, so I knew that. But I believe that, like, my sort of policy before doing this report was that, great, we have to find ways to navigate around that. We have to figure out how to get our work done despite that. And thus, my career has been full of theatrical projects that really fight against racism and anti-blackness on the stage, you know, but backstage, you know, and in the offices, it's still occurring and stuff. And I think that before this year, I thought that that was impossible to change. I think the entire year, but doing this report really taught me that everything is possible and actually anything can happen, which is terrifying, but it's also really, really very exciting. So I think that the ways in which we can have, like, you know, sort of anti-racist, you know, practices in the rehearsal room, as we're reading scripts, as we're talking to playwrights, is really important and interesting. I think that also, you know, the influence of money is inescapable in the American theater. And I do think that we need to accept that. But I think that, like, we have to commit ourselves to ways to make sure artists can feed themselves. They can't create the work if they can't put, you know, food on the table. And I think that at the Vineyard, that'll be a really big concentration of mine, is figure out ways, how can we have resident artists? How can we get people health insurance? You know, which one would think that that isn't my job, you know, as a sort of dramaturg, but it is. My job is to make sure that this writer can write a good play, and they need dinner and the ability to go to a doctor in order to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely sort of, you know, things that I'm thinking of. And then one last thing I'd say is that I think that there's incredible gravity right now at work as theaters start to open up. And I think that gravity is pulling us back to what was. And I think that we have to resist the urge to go back to what was because it wasn't good. And also because trying to go back to what was will not be successful. The old world is gone. You know, the new world is waiting for us, and we're at the edge of a cliff, and we're going to fall either way. And so, like, we either fall in fear or we fall and leap in excitement. So I'm leaping.
Yeah. And I think we all look forward to seeing what the new world will bring us. So thank you, Jesse. Thanks for chatting with me. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was Jesse Cameron Alec, who worked with the Sundance Institute to conduct the independent study Emerging from the Cave, Reimagining Our Future in Live Performance. The study is out today, and you can find out more at emergingfromthecave.com. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd so appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us grow our audience of folks who love theater as much as you and I do. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes or subscribe on all the pod places, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode. Until then, find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.